The Berkeley Hills seemed to be free of any Roman camp. Percy looked at his friends. Any idea what Terminus was talking about? Watch out for political something or other?
Polybetes?
Hazel sounded out the name carefully.
Never heard of him.
Sounds Greek, Frank said.
That narrows it down. Percy sighed. Well, we probably just appeared on the smell radar for every monster within 5 miles. We'd better get moving. It took them 2 hours to reach the docks in Alameda. Compared to Percy's last few months, the trip was easy. No monsters attacked. Nobody looked at Percy like he was a homeless wild child. Frank had stored his spear, bow, and quiver in a long bag made for skis. Hazel's cavalry sword was wrapped in a bedroll slung on her back. Together, the three of them looked like normal high schoolers on their way to an overnight trip. They walked to Rockridge Station, bought their tickets with mortal money, and hopped on the BART train. They got off in Oakland. They had to walk through some rough neighborhoods, but nobody bothered them. Whenever the local gang members came close enough to look in Percy's eyes, they quickly veered away. He'd perfected his wolf stare over the last few months, a look that said, "However bad you think you are, I'm worse." After strangling sea monsters and running over gorgons in a police car, Percy wasn't scared of gangs. Pretty much nothing in the mortal world scared him anymore. In the late afternoon, they made it to the Alameda docks. Percy looked out over San Francisco Bay and breathed in the salty sea air. Immediately, he felt better. This was his father's domain. Whatever they faced, he'd have the upper hand as long as they were at sea. Dozens of boats were moored at the docks, everything from 50-foot yachts to 10-foot fishing boats. He scanned the slips for some sort of magic vessel, a trireme, maybe, or a dragon-headed warship like he'd seen in his dreams.
You guys know what we're looking for?
Hazel and Frank shook their heads.
I didn't even know we had a navy.
Hazel sounded as if she wished there wasn't one.
Oh, Frank pointed. You don't think...
At the end of the dock was a tiny boat, like a dinghy, covered in a purple tarp. Embroidered in faded gold along the canvas was SPQR. Percy's confidence wavered.
No way.
He uncovered the boat, his hands working the knots like he'd been doing it his whole life. Under the tarp was an old steel rowboat with no oars. The boat had been painted dark blue at one point, but the hull was so crusted with tar and salt, it looked like one massive nautical bruise. On the bow, the name Pax was still readable, lettered in gold. Painted eyes drooped sadly at the water level, as if the boat were about to fall asleep. On board were two benches, some steel wool, an old cooler, and a mound of frayed rope with one end tied to the mooring. At the bottom of the boat, a plastic bag and two empty Coke cans floated in several inches of scummy water.
Behold, Frank said, the mighty Roman Navy.
There's got to be a mistake, Hazel said. This is a piece of junk.
Percy imagined Octavian laughing at them, but he decided not to let it get him down. The Pax was still a boat. He jumped aboard, and the hull hummed under his feet, responding to his presence. He gathered up the garbage in the cooler and put it on the dock. He willed the scummy water to flow over the sides and out of the boat. Then he pointed at the steel wool, and it flew across the floor. Scrubbing and polishing so fast, the steel began to smoke. When it was done, the boat was clean. Percy pointed at the rope, and it untied itself from the dock. No oars, but that didn't matter. Percy could tell that the boat was ready to move, just awaiting his command.
"This'll do," he said. "Hop in."
Hazel and Frank looked a little stunned, but they climbed aboard. Hazel seemed especially nervous. When they had settled on the seats, Percy concentrated, and the boat slipped away from the dock.
"Juno was right, you know,"
the sleepy voice of Gia whispered in Percy's mind, startling him so badly the boat rocked.
"You could have chosen a new life in the sea. You would have been safe from me there. Now it's too late. You chose pain and misery. You're part of my plan now, my important little pawn.
Get off my ship, Percy growled.
What?
Frank asked. Percy waited, but the voice of Gia was silent.
Nothing, he said. Let's see what this rowboat can do.
He turned the boat to the north, and in no time they were speeding along at 15 knots, heading for the Golden Gate Bridge. Chapter 17. Hazel. Hazel hated boats. She got seasick so easily, it was more like sea plague. She hadn't mentioned this to Percy. She didn't want to mess up the quest, but she remembered how horrible her life had been when she and her mother had moved to Alaska. No roads. Everywhere they went, they'd had to take the train or a boat. She hoped her condition might have improved since she'd come back from the dead. Obviously not. And this little boat, the Pax, looked so much like that other boat they'd had in Alaska. It brought back bad memories. As soon as they left the dock, Hazel's stomach started to churn. By the time they passed the piers along the San Francisco Embarcadero, she felt so woozy she thought she was hallucinating. They sped by a pack of sea lions lounging on the docks, and she swore she saw an old homeless guy sitting among them. From across the water, the old man pointed a bony finger at Percy and mouthed something like, "Don't even think about it."
"Did you see that?" Hazel asked.
Percy's face was red in the sunset.
"Yeah, I've been here before. I don't know. I think I was looking for my girlfriend."
"Annabeth," Frank said. "You mean on your way to Camp Jupiter?"
Percy frowned.
"No, before that."
He scanned the city like he was still looking for Annabeth until they passed under the Golden Gate Bridge and turned north. Hazel tried to settle her stomach by thinking of pleasant things. The euphoria she'd felt last night when they'd won the war games, riding Hannibal into the enemy keep. Frank's sudden transformation into a leader. He'd looked like a different person when he'd scaled the walls, calling on the 5th cohort to attack. The way he'd swept the defenders off the battlements. Hazel had never seen him like that before. She'd been so proud to pin the Centurion's badge to his shirt. Then her thoughts turned to Nico. Before they had left, her brother had pulled her aside to wish her luck. Hazel hoped he'd stay at Camp Jupiter to help defend it, but he said he'd be leaving today, heading back to the underworld.
"Dad needs all the help he can get," he said. "The fields of punishment look like a prison riot. The Furies can barely keep order. Besides, I'm going to try to track some of the escaping souls. Maybe I can find the doors of death from the other side."
"Be careful," Hazel said. "If Gia is guarding those doors..."
"Don't worry," Nico smiled. "I know how to stay hidden. Just take care of yourself, the closer you get to Alaska. I'm not sure if it'll make the blackouts better or worse."
"Take care of myself," Hazel thought bitterly, as if there was any way the quest would end well for her.
"If we free Thanatos," Hazel told Nico, "I may never see you again. Thanatos will send me back to the underworld."
Nico took her hand. His fingers were so pale it was hard to believe Hazel and he shared the same godly father.
"I wanted to give you a chance at Elysium," he said. "That was the best I could do for you. But now, I wish there was another way. I don't want to lose my sister."
He didn't say the word again, but Hazel knew that's what he was thinking. For once, she didn't feel jealous of Bianca D'Angelo. She just wished that she had more time with Nico and her friends at camp. She didn't want to die a second time.
"Good luck, Hazel," he said.
Then he melted into the shadows, just like her father had 70 years before. The boat shuddered, jolting Hazel back to the present. They entered the Pacific Currents and skirted the rocky coastline of Marin County. Frank held his ski bag across his lap. It passed over Hazel's knees like the safety bar on an amusement ride, which made her think of the time Sammy had taken her to the carnival during Mardi Gras. She quickly pushed that memory aside, She couldn't risk a blackout.
You okay? Frank asked. You look queasy.
Seasickness, she confessed. I didn't think it would be this bad.
Frank pouted like it was somehow his fault. He started digging in his pack.
I've got some nectar. And some crackers. My grandmother says ginger helps. I don't have any of that, but...
It's okay, Hazel mustered a smile. That's sweet of you, though.
Frank pulled out a saltine. It snapped in his big fingers. Cracker exploded everywhere. Hazel laughed.
Gods, Frank. Sorry. I shouldn't laugh.
No problem, he said sheepishly. Guess you don't want that one.
Percy wasn't paying much attention. He kept his eyes fixed on the shoreline. As they passed Stinson Beach, he pointed inland, where a single mountain rose above the green hills.
That looks familiar, he said.
Mount Tam, Frank said. Kids at camp are always talking about it. Big battle happened on the summit, at the old Titan base.
Percy frowned.
Were either of you there?
No, Hazel said. That was back in August, before I... Before I got to camp. Jason told me about it. The Legion destroyed the enemy's palace and about 1 million monsters. Jason had to battle Krios, hand-to-hand combat with a Titan, if you can imagine.
I can imagine, Percy muttered.
Hazel wasn't sure what he meant, but Percy did remind her of Jason, even though they looked nothing alike. They had the same aura of quiet power, plus a kind of sadness, like they'd seen their destiny and knew it was only a matter of time before they met a monster they couldn't beat. Hazel understood the feeling. She watched the sun set in the ocean, and she knew she had less than a week to live. Whether or not their quest succeeded, her journey would be over by the Feast of Fortuna. She thought about her first death, and the months leading up to it, her house in Seward, the 6 months she'd spent in Alaska, taking that little boat into Resurrection Bay at night, visiting that cursed island. She realized her mistake too late. Her vision went black, and she slipped back in time. Their rental house was a clapboard box suspended on pilings over the bay. When the train from Anchorage rolled by, the furniture shook and the pictures rattled on the walls. At night, Hazel fell asleep to the sound of icy water lapping against the rocks under the floorboards. The wind made the building creak and groan. They had one room, with a hot plate and an icebox for a kitchen. One corner was curtained off for Hazel, where she kept her mattress and storage chest. She pinned her drawings and old photos of New Orleans on the walls, but that only made her homesickness worse. Her mother was rarely home. She didn't go by Queen Marie anymore. She was just Marie, the hired help. She'd cook and clean all day at the diner on 3rd Avenue for fishermen, railroad workers, and the occasional crew of Navy men. She'd come home smelling like pine sol and fried fish. At night, Marie Levesque would transform. The voice took over, giving Hazel orders, putting her to work on their horrible project. Winter was the worst. The voice stayed longer because of the constant darkness. The cold was so intense, Hazel thought she would never be warm again. When summer came, Hazel couldn't get enough sun. Every day of summer vacation, she stayed away from home as long as she could, but she couldn't walk around town. It was a small community. The other kids spread rumors about her, the witch's child who lived in the old shack by the docks. If she came too close, the kids jeered at her or threw bottles and rocks. The adults weren't much better. Hazel could have made their lives miserable. She could have given them diamonds, pearls, or gold. Up here in Alaska, gold was easy. There was so much in the hills, Hazel could have buried the town without half trying. But she didn't really hate the locals for pushing her away. She couldn't blame them. She spent the day walking the hills. She attracted ravens. They'd caw at her from the trees and wait for the shiny things that always appeared in her footsteps. The curse never seemed to bother them. She saw brown bears, too, but they kept their distance. When Hazel got thirsty, she'd find a snowmelt waterfall and drink cold, clean water until her throat hurt. She'd climb as high as she could and let the sunshine warm her face. It wasn't a bad way to pass the time, but she knew eventually she'd have to go home. Sometimes she thought about her father, That strange pale man in the silver and black suit. Hazel wished he'd come back and protect her from her mother. Maybe use his powers to get rid of that awful voice. If he was a god, he should be able to do that. She looked up at the ravens and imagined they were his emissaries. Their eyes were dark and maniacal like his. She wondered if they reported her movements to her father. But Pluto had warned her mother about Alaska. It was a land beyond the gods. He couldn't protect them here. If he was watching Hazel, he didn't speak to her. She often wondered if she had imagined him. Her old life seemed as distant as the radio programs she listened to, or President Roosevelt talking about the war. Occasionally, the locals would discuss the Japanese and some fighting on the outer islands of Alaska, but even that seemed far away, not nearly as scary as Hazel's problem. One day in midsummer, she stayed out later than usual, chasing a horse. She'd seen it first when she had heard a crunching sound behind her. She turned and saw a gorgeous tan roan stallion with a black mane, just like the one she'd ridden her last day in New Orleans when Sammy had taken her to the stables. It could have been the same horse, though that was impossible. It was eating something off the path, and for a second, Hazel had the crazy impression it was munching one of the gold nuggets that always appeared in her wake. "Hey, fella," she called. The horse looked at her warily. Hazel figured it must belong to someone. It was too well groomed, its coat too sleek for a wild horse. If she could get close enough. What? She could find its owner? Return it? No, she thought. I just want to ride again. She got within 10 feet and the horse bolted. She spent the rest of the afternoon trying to catch it, getting maddeningly close before it ran away again. She lost track of time, which was easy to do with the summer sun staying up so long. Finally, she stopped at a creek for a drink and looked at the sky, thinking it must be around 3 in the afternoon. Then she heard a train whistle from down in the valley. She realized it had to be the evening run to Anchorage, which meant it was 10 at night. She glared at the horse grazing peacefully across the creek. "Are you trying to get me in trouble?" The horse whinnied. Then, Hazel must have imagined it. The horse sped away in a blur of black and tan, faster than forked lightning, almost too quick for her eyes to register. Hazel didn't understand how, but the horse was definitely gone. She stared at the spot where the horse had stood. A wisp of steam curled from the ground. The train whistle echoed through the hills again, and she realized how much trouble she was in. She ran for home. Her mother wasn't there. For a second, Hazel felt relieved. Maybe her mom had had to work late. Maybe tonight they wouldn't have to make the journey. Then she saw the wreckage. Hazel's curtain was pulled down, her storage chest was open, and her few clothes strewn across the floor. Her mattress had been shredded as if a lion had attacked it. Worst of all, her drawing pad was ripped to pieces. Her colored pencils were all broken. Pluto's birthday gift, Hazel's only luxury, had been destroyed. Pinned to the wall was a note in red on the last piece of drawing paper, in writing that was not her mother's. "Wicked girl, I'm waiting at the island. Don't disappoint me." Hazel sobbed in despair. She wanted to ignore the summons. She wanted to run away, but there was nowhere to go. Besides, her mother was trapped. The voice had promised that they were almost done with their task. If Hazel kept helping, her mother would be freed. Hazel didn't trust the voice, but she didn't see any other option. She took the rowboat, a little skiff her mother had bought with a few gold nuggets from a fisherman who had a tragic accident with his nets the next day. They had only one boat, but Hazel's mother seemed capable on occasion of reaching the island without any transportation. Hazel had learned not to ask about that. Even in midsummer, chunks of ice swirled in Resurrection Bay. Seals glided by her boat, looking at Hazel hopefully, sniffing for fish scraps. In the middle of the bay, the glistening back of a whale raked the surface. As always, the rocking of the boat made her stomach queasy. She stopped once to be sick over the side. The sun was finally going down over the mountains, turning the sky blood red. She rowed toward the bay's mouth. After several minutes, she turned and looked ahead. Right in front of her, Out of the fog, the island materialized, an acre of pine trees, boulders, and snow, with a black sand beach. If the island had a name, she didn't know it. Once Hazel had made the mistake of asking the townsfolk, but they had stared at her like she was crazy.
"Ain't no island there," said one old fisherman, "or my boat would have run into it 1,000 times.
Hazel was about 50 yards from the shore when a raven landed on the boat's stern. It was a greasy black bird almost as large as an eagle, with a jagged beak like an obsidian knife. Its eyes glittered with intelligence, so Hazel wasn't much surprised when it talked.
"Tonight," it croaked. "The last night."
Hazel let the oars rest. She tried to decide if the raven was warning her, or advising her, or making a promise.
"Are you from my father?" she asked.
The raven tilted his head.
"The last night. Tonight."
It pecked at the boat's prow and flew toward the island.
"The last night," Hazel told herself.
She decided to take it as a promise.
"No matter what she tells me, I will make this the last night."
That gave her enough strength to row on. The boat slid ashore, cracking through a fine layer of ice and black silt. Over the months, Hazel and her mother had worn a path from the beach into the woods. She hiked inland, careful to stick to the trail. The island was full of dangers, both natural and magical. Bears rustled in the undergrowth. Glowing white spirits, vaguely human, drifted through the trees. Hazel didn't know what they were, but she knew they were watching her, hoping she'd stray into their clutches. At the center of the island, two massive black boulders formed the entrance to a tunnel. Hazel made her way into the cavern she called the Heart of the Earth. It was the only truly warm place Hazel had found since moving to Alaska. The air smelled of freshly turned soil. The sweet, moist heat made Hazel feel drowsy, but she fought to stay awake. She imagined that if she fell asleep here, her body would sink into the earthen floor and turn to mulch. The cave was as large as a church sanctuary, like the St. Louis Cathedral back home on Jackson Square. The walls glowed with luminescent mosses, green, red, and purple. The whole chamber thrummed with energy, an echoing boom, 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 that reminded Hazel of a heartbeat. Perhaps it was just the sea's waves battering the island, but Hazel didn't think so. This place was alive. The earth was asleep, but it pulsated with power. Its dreams were so malicious, so fitful, that Hazel felt herself losing her grip on reality. Gia wanted to consume her identity, just as she'd overwhelmed Hazel's mother. She wanted to consume every human, god, and demigod that dared to walk across her surface.
"You all belong to me," Gia murmured like a lullaby. "Surrender. Return to the earth."
"No," Hazel thought. "I'm Hazel Levesque. You can't have me."
Marie Levesque stood over the pit. In 6 months, her hair had turned as gray as lint. She'd lost weight. Her hands were gnarled from hard work. She wore snow boots and waders and a stained white shirt from the diner. She never would have been mistaken for a queen.
"It's too late."
Her mother's frail voice echoed through the cavern. Hazel realized with a shock that it was her voice, not Gia's.
"Mother?"
Marie turned. Her eyes were open. She was awake and conscious. This should have made Hazel feel relieved, but it made her nervous. The voice had never relinquished control while they were on the island.
"What have I done?"
her mother asked helplessly.
"Oh, Hazel, what did I do to you?"
She stared in horror at the thing in the pit. For months they'd been coming here, 4 or 5 nights a week as the voice required. Hazel had cried. She'd collapsed with exhaustion. She'd pleaded. She'd given in to despair. But the voice that controlled her mother had urged her on relentlessly.
"Bring valuables from the earth. Use your powers, child. Bring my most valuable possession to me."
At first, her efforts had brought only scorn. The fissure in the earth had filled with gold and precious stones, bubbling in a thick soup of petroleum, It looked like a dragon's treasure dumped in a tar pit. Then, slowly, a rock spire began to grow like a massive tulip bulb. It emerged so gradually, night after night, that Hazel had trouble judging its progress. Often she concentrated all night on raising it, until her mind and soul were exhausted, but she didn't notice any difference. Yet the spire did grow. Now Hazel could see how much she'd accomplished. The thing was two stories high, a swirl of rocky tendrils jutting like a spear tip from the oily morass. Inside, something glowed with heat. Hazel couldn't see it clearly, but she knew what was happening. A body was forming out of silver and gold, with oil for blood and raw diamonds for a heart. Hazel was resurrecting the son of Gia. He was almost ready to wake. Her mother fell to her knees and wept.
"I'm sorry, Hazel. I'm so sorry."
She looked helpless and alone, horribly sad. Hazel should have been furious. Sorry? She'd lived in fear of her mother for years. She'd been scolded and blamed for her mother's unfortunate life. She'd been treated like a freak, dragged away from her home in New Orleans to this cold wilderness, and worked like a slave by a merciless evil goddess. Sorry didn't cut it. She should have despised her mother. But she couldn't make herself feel angry. Hazel knelt and put her arm around her mother. There was hardly anything left of her, just skin and bones and stained work clothes. Even in the warm cave, she was trembling.
"What can we do?" Hazel said. "Tell me how to stop it."
Her mother shook her head.
"She let me go. She knows it's too late. There's nothing we can do." "She? The voice?"
Hazel was afraid to get her hopes up, but if her mother was really freed, then nothing else mattered. They could get out of here. They could run away, back to New Orleans.
"Is she gone?"
Her mother glanced fearfully around the cave.
"No, she's here. There's only one more thing she needs from me. For that, she needs my free will."
Hazel didn't like the sound of that.
"Let's get out of here," she urged. "That thing in the rock, it's going to hatch."
"Soon," her mother agreed. She looked at Hazel so tenderly. Hazel couldn't remember the last time she'd seen that kind of affection in her mother's eyes. She felt a sob building in her chest.
"Pluto warned me," her mother said. "He told me my wish was too dangerous."
Your wish?"
"All the wealth under the earth," she said. "He controlled it. I wanted it. I was so tired of being poor, Hazel. So tired. First, I summoned him, just to see if I could. I never thought the old gree-gree spell would work on a god, but he courted me, told me I was brave and beautiful."
She stared at her bent, calloused hands.
"When you were born, he was so pleased and proud. He promised me anything. He swore on the river Styx. I asked for all the riches he had. He warned me the greediest wishes caused the greatest sorrows, but I insisted. I imagined living like a queen, the wife of a god, and you received the curse."
Hazel felt as if she were expanding to the breaking point, just like that spire in the pit. Her misery would soon become too great to hold inside, and her skin would shatter.
"That's why I can find things under the earth?
And why they bring only sorrow."
Her mother gestured listlessly around the cavern.
"That's how she found me, how she was able to control me. I was angry with your father. I blamed him for my problems. I blamed you. I was so bitter. I listened to Gia's voice. I was a fool."
"There's got to be something we can do," Hazel said. "Tell me how to stop her."
The ground trembled. Gia's disembodied voice echoed through the cave.
"My eldest rises," she said, "the most precious thing in the earth. And you have brought him from the depths, Hazel Levesque. You have made him anew. His awakening cannot be stopped. Only one thing remains."
Hazel clenched her fists. She was terrified, but now that her mother was free, she felt like she could confront her enemy at last. This creature, this evil goddess, had ruined their lives. Hazel wasn't going to let her win.
"I won't help you anymore," she yelled.
"But I am done with your help, girl. I brought you here for one reason only. Your mother required incentive." Hazel's throat constricted.
"Mother?"
"I'm sorry, Hazel. If you can forgive me, please know that it was only because I loved you.
She promised to let you live if you sacrifice yourself,"
Hazel said, realizing the truth.
"She needs you to give your life willingly to raise that thing."
"Alcyoneus," Gia said, "eldest of the giants. He must rise first, and this will be his new homeland, far from the gods. He will walk these icy mountains and forests. He will raise an army of monsters, while the gods are divided, fighting each other in this mortal world war. He will send forth his armies to destroy Olympus." The Earth Goddess's dreams were so powerful, they cast shadows across the cave walls, ghastly shifting images of Nazi armies raging across Europe, Japanese planes destroying American cities. Hazel finally understood. The gods of Olympus would take sides in the battle as they always did in human wars. While the gods fought each other to a bloody standstill, an army of monsters would rise in the north. Alcyoneus would revive his brother giants and send them forth to conquer the world. The weakened gods would fall. The mortal conflict would rage for decades until all civilization was swept away, and the Earth Goddess awakened fully. Gia would rule forever.
"All this," the goddess purred, "because your mother was greedy and cursed you with the gift of finding riches. In my sleeping state, I would have needed decades more, perhaps even centuries, before I found the power to resurrect Alcyoneus myself. But now he will wake, and soon so shall I."
With terrible certainty, Hazel knew what would happen next. The only thing Gia needed was a willing sacrifice, a soul to be consumed for Alcyoneus to awaken. Her mother would step into the fissure and touch that horrible spire, and she would be absorbed.
"Hazel, go."
Her mother rose unsteadily.
"She'll let you live, but you must hurry."
Hazel believed it. That was the most horrible thing. Gia would honor the bargain and let Hazel live. Hazel would survive to see the end of the world, knowing that she'd caused it.
"No," Hazel made her decision. "I won't live. Not for that."
She reached deep into her soul. She called on her father, the Lord of the Underworld, and summoned all the riches that lay in his vast realm. The cavern shook. Around the spire of Alcyoneus, oil bubbled, then churned and erupted like a boiling cauldron.
"Don't be foolish," Gia said.
But Hazel detected concern in her tone, maybe even fear.
"You will destroy yourself for nothing. Your mother will still die."
Hazel almost wavered. She remembered her father's promise. Someday her curse would be washed away. A descendant of Neptune would bring her peace. He'd even said she might find a horse of her own. Maybe that strange stallion in the hills was meant for her. But none of that would happen if she died now. She'd never see Sammy again or return to New Orleans. Her life would be 13 short, bitter years with an unhappy ending. She met her mother's eyes. For once, her mother didn't look sad or angry. Her eyes shone with pride.
"You were my gift, Hazel," she said. "My most precious gift. I was foolish to think I needed anything else."
She kissed Hazel's forehead and held her close. Her warmth gave Hazel the courage to continue. They would die, but not as sacrifices to Gia. Instinctively, Hazel knew that their final act would reject Gia's power. Their souls would go to the underworld, and Alcyoneus would not rise. At least not yet. Hazel summoned the last of her willpower. The air turned searing hot. The spire began to sink. Jewels and chunks of gold shot from the fissure with such force they cracked the cavern walls and sent shrapnel flying, stinging Hazel's skin through her jacket.
"Stop this," Gia demanded. "You cannot prevent his rise. At best, you will delay him. A few decades, half a century. Would you trade your lives for that?"
Hazel gave her an answer.
"The last night,"
the raven had said. The fissure exploded. The roof crumbled. Hazel sank into her mother's arms, into the darkness, as oil filled her lungs and the island collapsed into the bay. Chapter 18. Hazel.
"Hazel!"
Frank shook her arm, sounding panicked.
"Come on, please! Wake up!"
She opened her eyes. The night sky blazed with stars. The rocking of the boat was gone. She was lying on solid ground, her bundled sword and pack beside her. She sat up groggily, her head spinning. They were on a cliff overlooking a beach. About 100 feet away, the ocean glinted in the moonlight. The surf washed gently against the stern of their beached boat. To her right, hugging the edge of the cliff, was a building like a small church with a searchlight in the steeple. A lighthouse, Hazel guessed. Behind them, fields of tall grass rustled in the wind.
"Where are we?"
she asked. Frank exhaled.
"Thank the gods you're awake. We're in Mendocino, about 150 miles north of the Golden Gate."
150 miles?
Hazel groaned.
"I've been out that long?"
Percy knelt beside her, the sea wind sweeping his hair. He put his hand on her forehead as if checking for a fever.
"We couldn't wake you. Finally, we decided to bring you ashore. We thought maybe the seasickness..."
"It wasn't seasickness."
She took a deep breath. She couldn't hide the truth from them anymore. She remembered what Nico had said. "If a flashback like that happens when you're in combat..."
I haven't been honest with you," she said. "What happened was a blackout. I have them once in a while."
"A blackout?"
Frank took Hazel's hand, which startled her, though pleasantly so.
"Is it medical? Why haven't I noticed before?"
"I try to hide it," she admitted. "I've been lucky so far, but it's getting worse. It's not medical.
Not really."
"Nico says it's a side effect from my past, from where he found me."
Percy's intense green eyes were hard to read. She couldn't tell whether he was concerned or wary.
"Where exactly did Nico find you?" he asked.
Hazel's tongue felt like cotton. She was afraid if she started talking, she'd slip back into the past, but they deserved to know. If she failed them on this quest, zonked out when they needed her most, she couldn't bear that idea.
"I'll explain," she promised.
She clawed through her pack. Stupidly, she'd forgotten to bring a water bottle.
Is there anything to drink?"
"Yeah," Percy muttered a curse in Greek. "That was dumb. I left my supplies down at the boat."
Hazel felt bad asking them to take care of her, but she'd woken up parched and exhausted, as if she'd lived the last few hours in both the past and the present. She shouldered her pack and sword.
"Never mind. I can walk."
"Don't even think about it," Frank said. "Not until you've had some food and water. I'll get the supplies."
"No, I'll go."
Percy glanced at Frank's hand on Hazel's. Then he scanned the horizon as if he sensed trouble, but there was nothing to see, just the lighthouse and the field of grass stretching inland.
"You two stay here. I'll be right back."
"You sure?"
Hazel said feebly.
"I don't want you to..."
"It's fine," said Percy. "Frank, just keep your eyes open. Something about this place. I don't know."
"I'll keep her safe," Frank promised.
Percy dashed off. Once they were alone, Frank seemed to realize he was still holding Hazel's hand. He cleared his throat and let go.
I think I understand your blackouts," he said.
"And where you come from?"
Her heartbeat stumbled.
"You do?"
You seem so different from other girls I've met.
He blinked, then rushed on.
Not like bad different. Just the way you talk. The things that surprise you, like songs or TV shows or slang people use. You talk about your life like it happened a long time ago. You were born in a different time, weren't you? You came from the underworld.
Hazel wanted to cry, not because she was sad, but because it was such a relief to hear someone say the truth. Frank didn't act revolted or scared. He didn't look at her as if she were a ghost or some awful undead zombie.
Frank, we'll figure it out, he promised. You're alive now. We're going to keep you that way.
The grass rustled behind them. Hazel's eyes stung in the cold wind.
I don't deserve a friend like you, she said. You don't know what I am, what I've done.
Stop that, Frank scowled. You're great. Besides, you're not the only one with secrets.
Hazel stared at him.
I'm not?
Frank started to say something, then he tensed.
What?
Hazel asked.
The wind stopped.
She looked around and noticed he was right. The air had become perfectly still.
So?
She asked. Frank swallowed.
So why is the grass still moving?
Out of the corner of her eye, Hazel saw dark shapes ripple through the field.
Hazel!
Frank tried to grab her arms, but it was too late. Something knocked him backward. Then a force like a grassy hurricane wrapped around Hazel and dragged her into the fields. Chapter 19. Hazel. Hazel was an expert on weird. She'd seen her mother possessed by an earth goddess. She'd created a giant out of gold. She'd destroyed an island, died, and come back from the underworld. But getting kidnapped by a field of grass? That was new. She felt as if she were trapped in a funnel cloud of plants. She'd heard of modern-day singers jumping into crowds of fans and getting passed overhead by thousands of hands. She imagined this was similar, only she was moving 1,000 times faster and the grass blades weren't adoring fans. She couldn't sit up. She couldn't touch the ground. Her sword was still in her bedroll, strapped to her back, but she couldn't reach it. The plants kept her off balance, tossing her around, slicing her face and arms. She could barely make out the stars through the tumble of green, yellow, and black. Frank's shouting faded into the distance. It was hard to think clearly, but Hazel knew one thing. She was moving fast. Wherever she was being taken, she'd soon be too far away for her friends to find her. She closed her eyes and tried to ignore the tumbling and tossing. She sent her thoughts into the earth below her. Gold, silver. She'd settle for anything that might disrupt her kidnappers. She felt nothing. Riches under the earth, zero. She was about to despair when she felt a huge cold spot pass beneath her. She locked onto it with all her concentration, dropping a mental anchor. Suddenly the ground rumbled. The swirl of plants released her and she was thrown upward like a catapult projectile. Momentarily weightless, she opened her eyes. She twisted her body in midair. The ground was about 20 feet below her. Then she was falling. Her combat training kicked in. She'd practiced dropping from giant eagles before. She tucked into a roll, turned the impact into a somersault, and came up standing. She unslung her bedroll and drew her sword. A few yards to her left, an outcropping of rock the size of a garage jutted from the sea of grass. Hazel realized it was her anchor. She'd caused the rock to appear. The grass rippled around it. Angry voices hissed in dismay at the massive clump of stone that had broken their progress. Before they could regroup, Hazel ran to the rock and clambered to the top. The grass swayed and rustled around her like the tentacles of a giant undersea anemone. Hazel could sense her kidnapper's frustration.
"Can't grow on this, can you?"
she yelled.
"Go away, you bunch of weeds! Leave me alone!"
"Shist!"
said an angry voice from the grass. Hazel raised her eyebrows.
"Excuse me?"
"Shist! Big pile of shist!"
A nun at St. Agnes Academy had once washed Hazel's mouth with lye soap for saying something very similar, so she wasn't sure how to respond. Then, all around her rock island, the kidnappers materialized from the grass. At first glance, they looked like Valentine angels, 12 chubby little Cupid babies.
As they stepped closer, Hazel realized they were neither cute nor angelic. They were the size of toddlers, with rolls of baby fat, but their skin had a strange greenish hue, as if chlorophyll ran through their veins. They had dry, brittle wings like corn husks, and tufts of white hair like corn silk. Their faces were haggard, pitted with kernels of grain. Their eyes were solid green, and their teeth were canine fangs. The largest creature stepped forward. He wore a yellow loincloth, and his hair was spiky, like the bristles on a stalk of wheat. He hissed at Hazel and waddled back and forth so quickly, she was afraid his loincloth might fall off.
"Hate this shist," the creature complained.
"Wheat cannot grow. Sorghum cannot grow,"
another piped up.
"Barley,"
yelled a third.
"Barley cannot grow. Curse this shist."
Hazel's knees wobbled. The little creatures might have been funny if they weren't surrounding her, staring up at her with those pointed teeth and hungry green eyes. They were like Cupid piranhas.
You mean the rock?" she managed. "This rock is called schist?"
"Yes, Greenstone, schist,"
the first creature yelled.
"Nasty rock."
Hazel began to understand how she'd summoned it.
"It's a precious stone. It's valuable?"
"Bah,"
said the one in the yellow loincloth.
"Foolish native people made jewelry from it, yes. Valuable? Maybe. Not as good as wheat. Or sorghum.
Or barley."
The others chimed in, calling out different types of grain. They circled the rock, making no effort to climb it, at least not yet. If they decided to swarm her, there was no way she could fend off all of them.
"Your Gia's servants," she guessed, just to keep them talking. Maybe Percy and Frank weren't too far away. Maybe they'd be able to see her, standing so tall above the fields. She wished that her sword glowed like Percy's.
The yellow-diapered Cupid snarled.
"We are the Karpoi, spirits of the grain, children of the Earth Mother, yes. We have been her attendants since forever. Before nasty humans cultivated us, we were wild. We will be again. We will destroy all.
No, sorghum will rule. Barley shall dominate."
The others joined in, each Karpus cheering for his own variety.
"Right," Hazel swallowed her revulsion. "So you're wheat, then? You in the yellow, britches?"
"Hmm,"
said Wheat.
"Come down from your schist, dummy god. We must take you to our mistress's army. They will reward us. They will kill you slowly."
"Tempting," Hazel said, "but no thanks."
"I will give you wheat," said Wheat,
as if this were a very fine offer in exchange for her life.
"So much wheat."
Hazel tried to think. How far had she been carried? How long would it take her friends to find her? The Karpoi were getting bolder, approaching the rock in twos and threes, scratching at the schist to see if it would hurt them.
"Before I get down,"
she raised her voice, hoping it would carry over the fields,
"explain something to me, would you? If you're grain spirits, shouldn't you be on the gods' side? Isn't the goddess of agriculture Ceres?"
"Evil name,"
Barley wailed.
"Cultivates us,"
sorghum spat.
"Makes us grow in disgusting rows. Let humans harvest us. Pah! When Gia is mistress of the world again, we will grow wild, yes."
"Well, naturally," Hazel said. "So this army of hers, where you're taking me in exchange for wheat."
"Or barley,"
Barley offered.
"Yeah," Hazel agreed. "This army is where now?"
"Just over the ridge."
Sorghum clapped his hands excitedly.
"The Earth Mother, oh yes. She told us, look for the daughter of Pluto who lives again. Find her, bring her alive. I have many tortures planned for her. The giant Polybetes will reward us for your life. Then we will march south to destroy the Romans. We can't be killed, you know, but you can, yes."
"That's wonderful,"
Hazel tried to sound enthusiastic. It wasn't easy, knowing Gia had special revenge planned for her.
"So you can't be killed because Alcyoneus has captured death, is that it?"
"Exactly,"
Barley said.
And he's keeping him chained in Alaska, Hazel said. At, let's see, what's the name of that place?
Sorghum started to answer, but wheat flew at him and knocked him down. The carpoy began to fight, dissolving into funnel clouds of grain. Hazel considered making a run for it. Then wheat reformed, holding sorghum in a headlock.
Stop! He yelled at the others. Multigrain fighting is not allowed.
The carpoy solidified into chubby cupid piranhas again. Wheat pushed sorghum away.
Oh, clever demigod, he said. Trying to trick us into giving secrets. No, you'll never find the lair of Alcyonius.
I already know where it is, she said with false confidence. He's on the island, in Resurrection Bay.
Ha!
Wheat sneered.
That place sank beneath the waves long ago. You should know that. Gia hates you for it. When you thwarted her plans, she was forced to sleep again. Decades and decades. Alcyonius, not until the dark times was he able to rise.
The 1980s,
Barley agreed.
Horrible, horrible.
Yes, Wheat said. And our mistress still sleeps. Alcyonius was forced to bide his time in the north, waiting, planning. Only now does Gia begin to stir. Oh, but she remembers you, and so does her son.
Sorghum cackled with glee.
You will never find the prison of Thanatos. All of Alaska is the giant's home. He could be keeping death anywhere. Years it would take you to find him, and your poor camp has only days. Better you surrender. We will give you grain. So much grain.
Hazel's sword felt heavy. She dreaded returning to Alaska, but at least she'd had an idea where to start looking for Thanatos. She'd assumed that the island where she had died had been completely destroyed, or possibly had risen again when Alcyonius woke. She had hoped that his base would be there. But if the island was really gone, she had no idea how to find the giant. Alaska was huge. They could search for decades and never find him.
Yes, Wheat said, sensing her anguish. Give up.
Hazel gripped her spatha.
Never!
She raised her voice again, hoping it would somehow reach her friends.
If I have to destroy you all, I will. I am the daughter of Pluto.
The carpoy advanced. They gripped the rock, hissing as if it were scalding hot, but they began to climb.
Now you will die, we promised, gnashing his teeth. You will feel the wrath of grain.
Suddenly there was a whistling sound. Wheat's snarl froze. He looked down at the golden arrow that had just pierced his chest. Then he dissolved into pieces of Chex Mix. Chapter 20 Hazel. For a heartbeat, Hazel was just as stunned as the carpoy. Then Frank and Percy burst into the open and began to massacre every source of fiber they could find. Frank shot an arrow through Barley, who crumbled into seeds. Percy slashed Riptide through sorghum and charged toward millet and oats. Hazel jumped down and joined the fight. Within minutes, the carpoy had been reduced to piles of seeds and various breakfast cereals. Wheat started to reform, but Percy pulled a lighter from his pack and sparked a flame.
Try it, he warned, and I'll set this whole field on fire. Stay dead, stay away from us, or the grass gets it.
Frank winced, like the flame terrified him. Hazel didn't understand why, but she shouted at the grain piles anyway.
He'll do it! He's crazy!
The remnants of the carpoy scattered in the wind. Frank climbed the rock and watched them go. Percy extinguished his lighter and grinned at Hazel.
Thanks for yelling. We wouldn't have found you otherwise. How'd you hold them off so long?
She pointed to the rock.
A big pile of schist.
Excuse me?
Guys, Frank called from the top of the rock, you need to see this.
Percy and Hazel climbed up to join him. As soon as Hazel saw what he was looking at, she inhaled sharply.
Percy, no light. Put up your sword.
Schist.
He touched the sword tip, and Riptide shrank back into a pen. Down below them, an army was on the move. The field dropped into a shallow ravine where a country road wound north and south. On the opposite side of the road, grassy hills stretched to the horizon, empty of civilization except for one darkened convenience store at the top of the nearest rise. The whole ravine was full of monsters, column after column marching south. So many and so close. Hazel was amazed they hadn't heard her shouting. She, Frank, and Percy crouched against the rock. They watched in disbelief as several dozen large, hairy humanoids passed by, dressed in tattered bits of armor and animal fur. The creatures had six arms each, three sprouting on either side, so they looked like cavemen evolved from insects.
"Jejeans," Hazel whispered. "The Earthborn."
"You fought them before?" Percy asked.
She shook her head.
"Just heard about them in Monster Class at camp."
She'd never liked Monster Class. Reading Pliny the Elder and those other musty authors who described legendary monsters from the edges of the Roman Empire. Hazel believed in monsters, but some of the descriptions were so wild, she had thought they must be just ridiculous rumors. Only now, a whole army of those rumors was marching by.
"The Earthborn fought the Argonauts," she murmured. "And those things behind them."
"Centaurs," Percy said.
"But that's not right. Centaurs are good guys."
Frank made a choking sound.
"That's not what we were taught at camp. Centaurs are crazy, always getting drunk and killing heroes."
Hazel watched as the horsemen cantered past. They were human from the waist up, Palomino from the waist down. They were dressed in barbarian armor of hide and bronze, armed with spears and slings. At first, Hazel thought they were wearing Viking helmets. Then she realized they had actual horns jutting from their shaggy hair.
"Are they supposed to have bull's horns?" she asked.
"Maybe they're a special breed," Frank said.
"Let's not ask them, okay?" Percy gazed farther down the road and his face went slack.
"My gods. Cyclopes."
Sure enough, lumbering after the centaurs was a battalion of one-eyed ogres, both male and female, each about 10 feet tall, wearing armor cobbled out of junkyard metal. Six of the monsters were yoked like oxen, pulling a 2-story-tall siege tower fitted with a giant scorpion ballista. Percy pressed the sides of his head.
"Cyclopes, centaurs, this is wrong, all wrong."
The monster army was enough to make anyone despair, but Hazel realized that something else was going on with Percy. He looked pale and sickly in the moonlight, as if his memories were trying to come back, scrambling his mind in the process. She glanced at Frank.
"We need to get him back to the boat. The sea will make him feel better."
"No argument," Frank said. "There are too many of them."
"The camp! We have to warn the camp."
"They know," Percy groaned. "Raina knows."
A lump formed in Hazel's throat. There was no way the Legion could fight so many. If they were only a few hundred miles north of Camp Jupiter, their quest was already doomed. They could never make it to Alaska and back in time.
"Come on,"
she urged.
"Let's..."
Then she saw the giant. When he appeared over the ridge, Hazel couldn't quite believe her eyes. He was taller than the siege tower, 30 feet at least, with scaly reptilian legs like a Komodo dragon from the waist down and green-blue armor from the waist up. His breastplate was shaped like rows of hungry, monstrous faces, their mouths open as if demanding food. His face was human, but his hair was wild and green, like a mop of seaweed. As he turned his head from side to side, snakes dropped from his dreadlocks. Viper dandruff. Gross. He was armed with a massive trident and a weighted net. Just the sight of those weapons made Hazel's stomach clench. She'd faced that type of fighter in gladiator training many times. It was the trickiest, sneakiest, most evil combat style she knew. This giant was a super-sized Retiarius.
"Who is he?"
Frank's voice quivered.
"That's not..."
"Not Alcyonius," Hazel said weakly. "One of his brothers, I think. The one Terminus mentioned. The grain spirit mentioned him, too. That's Polybetes."
She wasn't sure how she knew, but she could feel the giant's aura of power even from here. She remembered that feeling from the heart of the earth as she had raised Alcyonius, as if she were standing near a powerful magnet, and all the iron in her blood was being drawn toward it. This giant was another child of Gia, a creature of the earth.